Good evening. Good to see everybody. Last week, we covered the first 10 verses of chapter 2. Heading in my Bible, that section says the chosen stone and the chosen people. Thank Landon for reading. To kind of get the context a little bit, let's back up a couple of verses and read verses 9 and 10, and then this first verse, verse 11 as well. So 1 Peter 2, 9 through 11. But you are a chosen generation, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, his own special people, that you may proclaim the praises of him who called you out of darkness into his marvelous light, who once were not a people, but are now the people of God, who had not obtained mercy, but now has obtained mercy. In this verse, beloved, I beg you as sojourners and pilgrims, abstain from fleshly lusts, which war against the soul. The question is, for verse 11, question number one, the first part is, what makes us sojourners and pilgrims? And the second part is, how should identifying as such affect how we behave? So, Josh answered the last question. Grant, would you like to answer this question?
Sure. So, in general, a sojourner or a pilgrim, I think, was on a journey to, it was a religious journey to get to a place of importance of religious value. And so, we, as we live our lives, are making our way towards heaven as our journey through life. And so, that's what makes us a pilgrim or a sojourner, because we're living this life in a way that we look to reach heaven as our final destination. And so how should this affect how we behave? We should be living our lives in such a way that we don't really kind of put down roots as far as this world is a place that we want to spend eternity. We want to make sure we spend eternity in heaven. So we don't necessarily stop on the journey to take up residence here, but to continue on.
Thank you. We also would like to address this verse about sojourners and pilgrims and how it should drive us to behave.
Appreciate Grant's words there. I think it's interesting too when you think about what it means to be a pilgrim and a sojourner. It reminds me of the words of Jesus. I'm not going to be able to find it. The present, but exactly which verse? But when he was being tried, he proclaimed that my kingdom is not of this world. Right? Otherwise, my servants would fight. But that proclamation and the fact that we are citizens of a kingdom that is not of this world, no different than if any of us were to go to a different country, we would be sojourners or pilgrims there in a certain respect, or visitors, if you want to put it as such, because that's not our home place. That's not where we actually belong. And I think that's important to remember when we're here in this world is that because we belong to a kingdom that is not of this world, we don't belong in this world. We're just passing through until we get there.
Citizens of heaven, foreign nations. Okay. Bill.
This verse one, kind of reminds me of, or verse 11, reminds me of verse 1, chapter 2, verse 1. In chapter 1, verses 13 through 16, where Peter he's continuing his theme of living holy lives. He's encouraging these people of the dispensation. You're being pushed into other areas. You got to live holy lives. And we'll see, again, we'll continue to see why this is so important. I like the idea of our citizenship. You know, I've said it before, we're running a marathon, not a race, and by that same token, we need to be able to run a marathon. You need to be able to look ahead. You can't look at goals just here, like tomorrow's goals or next week's goals. These need to be long-term goals, and that's the way our Christian life is. It's a long-term process, continually striving to improve.
Anybody else? Bill kind of tied into the last part of verse 11 to Peter's call to be holy in the previous parts of chapter 1 and chapter 2. I think if we look at the first part of the question, I think we can also tie that back to the earlier part, earlier chapters. So in chapter 1 and verse 4, Peter says, "To an inheritance incorruptible and undefiled that does not fade away, reserved in heaven." Austin was talking about citizens in heaven. The Christian's inheritance is in heaven. And then back in verse 10 of this chapter, "We were not once not a people, but now are people of God, who had not obtained mercy, but now have obtained mercy." So I think Peter's kind of tying back into the Israel and the patriarchs here. The physical Israel, you know, they looked for an inheritance as it went through the wilderness. That was their goal. And I think Peter's kind of giving the Christians that same type of thing. And it's, if we look at Hebrews 11, 13 to 16, Hebrews 11, 13, 16. "These all died in faith, not having received the promises, but having seen them afar off, were assured of them, embraced them, and confessed them. They were strangers and pilgrims on the earth. For those who say such things declare plainly they seek a homeland. And truly, if they called to mind that country from which they had come out, they would have had an opportunity to return. But now they desire a better. That is a heavenly country. Therefore, God is not ashamed to be called their God, for he has prepared a city for them." You know, here in this verse, verse 11 of the chapter we're looking at tonight, says, "Abstain from fleshly lusts which war against the soul." You know, physical Israel wasn't supposed to look back to Egypt or look to the Canaanites. They were looked to the land that they were going to enjoy. And I also thought about Naboth. If we go to 1 Kings 21, verse 3. "But Naboth said to Ahab, 'The Lord forbid that I should give the inheritance of my fathers to you.'" Old Ahab, he wanted Naboth's vineyard. He wanted his inheritance, but Naboth knew that was God's will. You know, that was part of what Israel looked for, was their inheritance in the land. He wasn't willing to give that up. Anybody else on this question? Going to question number 2. And this is verse 12. Verse 12 reads, "Having your conduct honorable among the Gentiles, when they speak against you as evildoers, they may, by your good works which they observe, glorify God in the day of visitation." So why was honorable conduct so important for Christians to whom the epistle was written? Second part, is it still important to us today? And the tough question, what is the day of visitation? Trace, would you like to address these?
So I would say that it's important for us as Christians to act honorable, period, in all days and age. So to answer both first and second question, yeah, we should always act honorable in front of people of the world. That would be wise, because we're supposed to shine God's light and be an example to them. And we can't do that if we're just acting like them, and we're not, you know, trying to be separate and act sanctified like we're supposed to. I have some verses under consideration. So first, Philippians 2:15, it says, that you may become blameless and harmless children of God, without fault in the midst of a crooked and perverse generation, among whom you shine as lights in the world. And then Matthew, Jesus says in chapter 5, verse 16 reads, "Let your light so shine before men that they may see your good works and glorify your Father in heaven." And then finally, Matthew 9:8, it reads, "Now when the multitude saw it, they marveled and glorified God, who had given such power to men." So, that brings me to the visitation part. To me, without studying it too much, it seems like in the context would be the day of judgment. I think it's good that men glorify God before that, obviously, but visitation kind of to me has stood out as more of kind of the last day. So.
Who else might talk about why our conduct is important, what the day of visitation is?
Well, remember that Peter is writing to the dispersion, chapter 1 and verse 1. These would have been people from Rome, region around Rome, I suppose, mostly, that were pushed out into Pontus, Galatia, Asia, Bethany, Cappadocia. So these people were the sojourners and pilgrims, literally, I think they were literally sojourners and pilgrims as they were being pushed out of their home, being persecuted. And so now, at least some of these people were possibly just setting down somewhere as their new home. I can see these people being pushed out, and he's encouraging them now, as you go into these areas, you got to be on your best behavior. Remember, Nero had burned part of Rome, blamed the Christians, they were getting persecuted and they fled. And these fleeing Christians needed to demonstrate that they were good, honest people by their works after settling into these areas. That second part, absolutely. Trace, I like your Matthew chapter 5, verse 16. And then I went to Luke. I went for that third part, what is the day of visitation? Luke 19, verse 44, Jesus mentions that they missed it. They didn't recognize his day of visitation. Not Jesus, Luke. No, Jesus. Jesus referenced that the Jews not knowing the time of their visitation. So the Jews didn't know. And for me, it seems to me like all mankind is going to have a day of visitation. We're all going to have a day of visitation. Whether it's the Lord coming before we die or it's after we die, there's going to be a time when we're going to have that meeting with the Lord and have to go through that process. Some are going to look forward to it. Most are going to be surprised. Might be after our death or the Lord may come. Psalms 106 and verse 4. Although the Lord visits mankind with judgment, he also visits with salvation.
Okay. Anybody else want to talk about honorable conduct or the day of visitation? Awesome.
So on the day of visitation, I agree 100% with Bill. I want to point out something from the Greek. So it's the word episkope, which is kind of the same root where we get episkopos or bishop, elder, overseer. So Barnes here in his commentary, he says that this particular word means the act of visiting or being visited for any purpose, usually with the notion of inspecting conduct, of inflicting punishment, or of conferring favors. So I think that definition matches up with more of a final judgment type of where God is inspecting. He comes calling, if you will, in his oversight of humanity. So just throw that out there.
All right. Which word was this?
It's episcopate, which is visitation.
Thank you. Levi, way back there, back.
I thought it was interesting to note that in verse 11 it says, abstain from fleshly lust with war against the soul, and then it continues in verse 12, having your conduct honorable among the Gentiles. So it seems what these fleshly lusts are things that the Gentiles are participating in or could be observing. So this could be temples, going to temples and things like that. So I think reinforcing the already ample motivation to not go to these things. And then kind of wanted to step in for my dad here. He had some comments on different viewpoint as far as what is the day of visitation. He said, I favor it being the destruction of Jerusalem, because in that day there was a distinction. In that day, a distinction was seen between the Jews and the Christians. The Christians were revealed to be the good citizens of Rome, while the Jews were revealed to be traitors and rebellious. All the words of the Jews were disproved, and the Gentiles knew that the Christians were innocent of the crimes with which they were charged. So that's what he had to say about that.
Very good. So, in the context, I mean, of verse 12, it seems that the honorable conduct is there really to make the accusations be baseless. And day of visitation, I think it was maybe Barnes that I looked at, had several options there. You know, perhaps final judgment has been mentioned, destruction of Jerusalem, or when the gospel is preached among the Gentiles, or any other time when God visits. I kind of thought about, you know, the many times that the angel of the Lord was in the Old Testament, showed up, and you never really knew, you know, people there didn't know who it was. Anybody else on this question? Let's go to question number 3. Why do we submit to governing authorities? How thorough is our submission to worldly authorities supposed to be? Why is there a distinction made between submitting to the king and the governor? This is verses 13 and 14. Therefore, submit yourselves to every ordinance of man for the Lord's sake, whether to the king as supreme or the governors, as to those who are sent by him for the punishment of evildoers and for the praise of those who do good. Man, if you'd like this multi-part question.
Sure. So for the first part, I think it's definitely a good thing to do as Christians. We want to follow the rulers over us. Shows that we're subject to their authority. And we can find this in Romans 13 and 1. Reads, let every soul be subject to the governing authorities, for there is no authority except from God, and the authorities that exist are appointed by God. And then you can keep reading through verses 7 if you guys want. You know, this shows that they, you know, they're appointed by God. I think we've already talked about that in the past. So it could be a good example, you know, to those we interact with from work or whatever, who are following and abiding by the law. The second part here, how thorough is our submission to worldly authority supposed to be? And I think that we follow the laws as best that we can, you know, unless it interferes with God's laws. And we've kind of seen that over the past couple of years, COVID and everything. So we want to make sure that we're following God's laws above the man-made laws. And the last part here, the distinction between the king and the governor. I wasn't exactly sure. I just think that it kind of shows, I guess, mutual respect for both of them, whether it be a king or governor, you know, local places. You know, we all have municipalities, but then we also rulers of higher authority. So we kind of want to obey them all as best as we can. And it all ties in with being submissive and following the law to the best of our abilities. And to live peaceable lives. And if I could just read one more verse, Romans 12 and 18, talks about being peaceable here. It says, if it is possible, as much as depends on you, live peaceably with all men.
Thank you. Very good. We also like to address why we submit, how thorough, and the distinction between the king and God.
Acts chapter 5, verse 29. I think that was Peter saying that we ought to obey God rather than men after being taken before the rulers. So up until the point, we need to obey government, state, national, local, as best we can, is up until the point and until it causes us to violate God's law. And so that's where we need to be able and willing to draw a line. I thought it was ironic that Peter is commanding honor to the king, most likely reference to Nero. And here's Nero that had been driving these people out and causing the majority of these problems for the Christians. And Peter's still telling them, be respectful, honor the king. And this is the guy that's going to kill Peter pretty soon.
Right, yeah. Nero would have been a pretty tough emperor to honor. Who else? Awesome.
I love what's been said so far and making the distinction between kind of the big government and the little government, you know, the national versus the local. And I think it's really interesting that he brings out both here, and he may be kind of unique in doing that, because Paul in Romans 13, like Malin says, it's kind of a blanket statement, but it seems to apply to more the big nationalistic type of government. Now, I think from that, and I think we have correctly pointed out that applies to other forms of government as well, but it's popular in today's world for some of the more, oddballs out there. You know, they love their First Amendment rights, and they think that gives them the right to then go against local governments, or, you know, you don't have to obey pretty much anything else, any other type of government, but you do have, because you have a First Amendment right. And I think this points out the fact that it's all levels from top to bottom, and in some ways, maybe you have a really good governor, but you have a poor king, like was probably going on here, or vice versa. Still doesn't give you the right to disrespect or disobey any forms of that, as Bill pointed out, unless it goes against God's law.
I don't know who it was, which commentator is pointing this out, but in the Roman system, the emperor would set some big bounds, and then the governors, their main goal was to keep peace in their area. So they might add stuff, you know, add laws, add restrictions and so forth, and that may be why Peter includes them there, because they may have been more heavy-handed than even the emperor was in just trying to keep things calm down. And you kind of see an example of that with Pilate. I mean, that was his goal, was to keep things calm down in that area. Bill had the verse Acts 5:29. I think the other verse of I think of when the limitations on when to obey is Exodus 1:17. But the midwives feared God and did not do as the king of Egypt commanded them. It saved the male children alive. Now, these were some pretty brave women. Anybody else on this question? Question number 4. This is on verse number 15.
For this is the will of God, that by doing good you may put to silence the ignorance of foolish men. The question is, why is it God's will to silence critics through our morality? How well have Christians done in fulfilling God's will in this respect, generally speaking? Logan, would you like this question?
Sure. It's the age-old adage of actions speak louder than words, right? And I think that's probably the truest for Christianity. By our deeds, by our works, how we treat people, how we interact with people on a day-to-day basis, that's the kind of thing that maybe you're not aware of all the time, but for most people it will be the biggest impact that you have on them. Just the manner in which you carry yourself, how friendly you are, how generous you are with other people. And when people see that, they see the light in you, and they may have evil thoughts, evil intentions. That's just some people. I find most people are good people. They just might be confused or lost in some way, but living the right life is much better than just empty words or hypocritical lifestyle that you could be living just by saying words just to look at. It's kind of what I had for that question. I just thought of that question as just kind of like a general reflection on what it means to be a Christian, how you should be living. So that's why.
Okay. Who else would like to address? Why is it God's will to silence critics through morality, and how well has this been done? By the context, one of the best ways to silence a critic, kind of what Logan was getting at, was strict integrity does that. It demonstrates the accusations of foolish and wicked people are incorrect, and it's what Jesus did. And I forgot to look up this verse, but we think about when they questioned Jesus about his teaching there in his final days. He says, well, I taught openly in synagogues, and I got nothing to hide. We also see some verses like Matthew 6, 5 and 6. Pray, you shall not be like the hypocrites, for they love to pray standing in the synagogues and on the corners of the streets, that they may be seen by men. And surely I say to you, they have their reward. But you, when you pray, go into your room, and when you have shut your door, pray to your Father who is in a secret place, and your Father who sees you will reward you openly. So it's not only for to silence the critics, but it's also that God sees. And that was, regardless, we're called to live a life of strict integrity, no matter who sees. And I'll repeat this verse often, but it's, I think, one of my favorite. Micah 6:8. He has shown you, O man, what is good, and what does the Lord require of you but to do justly, to love mercy, and walk humbly with your God. We're always, in all dispensations, before God, we're to walk with integrity. Who else would like to address this verse?
No.
But
why is it God's will to silence critics through morality? I answered that it's a passive, non-aggressive method of defense. And that falls right in line with the life that Christ led. Christ wasn't aggressive, outgoing attack kind of person at all.
He was passive. He lived, he stood up for himself, but he was passive and non-combative. Peter's instructions to those being persecuted or harassed by being Christians, remember, this is the audience, it is to make their good deeds a feature of their lives. Okay, so Karen and I were talking about this a little bit today. When you think about, again, we've tried to imagine what it was like for all these Hebrew, Jew families, living in Thessalonica or whatever, pick a town. They're probably all within a couple of miles of each other. And there was somebody that was a tailor, there was somebody that was a butler, there was somebody that was a blacksmith, a butcher. You had all these trades, and people knew it. Again, it was a different world. But how does the butcher demonstrate good deeds? By being fair and just. And the same way with the tailor. And by those kind of good deeds are recognized in the community. It's a whole lot different world than we have now, because they were so close. They knew, word got around. You think if I gave Austin an extra pork chop when he came to my butcher shop, that he wouldn't go back and tell his neighbor? And word would get around. It's that kind of thing. And it could be the blacksmith or the tailor. And it's a little harder for us today. But our defense, our witnessing, I don't really like using that word a lot because it's popular and mainstream, but we witness by our good deeds, just like Logan said. Oh, and the second part of this question. How well have Christians done in fulfilling God's will in this respect, generally speaking? You got people claiming to be Christians that are instigating civil wars, murderers, thieves. My vote's poor. I don't think Christians have done a very good job of doing it. And it makes me think of myself. And all of us can see times when we could maybe put a little better foot forward.
For the second, this is not really the second part of the question, but looking from the eyes of the accusers, I think maybe in this chapter, I read an article this week. It was an NPR article. So it was about the National Prayer Breakfast, and there's a group of evangelical Christians that kind of led the National Prayer Breakfast. It's called the Fellowship Foundation. And they looked at this through very suspicious eyes about all the things that they were doing secretly. And I think that's kind of the way that the people, the accusers that Peter's talked about, I think, I get the feeling it was that same type of suspicious things, that the suspicion that these people had against Christians as we see today. With some people in society. Anybody else on this question? Question number 5. What freedoms and liberties does a Christian have that could be used as cloak or vice? Landon.
So that word there, for vice, could also be translated maliciousness or evil. The ESV renders that saying as a liberty, as a cover up for evil. So some of the Christians there at that day were, I guess, using the liberty, the freedom, they were trying to say that they were free from moral laws, civil laws, that they could indulge themselves in sins because they were free. And there's a verse from Jude 3 and 4 that talks about this. Beloved, while I was very diligent to write to you concerning our common salvation, I found it necessary to write to you, exhorting you to contend earnestly for the faith which was once for all delivered to the saints. For certain men have crept in unnoticed, who long ago were marked out for this condemnation, ungodly men who turned the grace of our God into lewdness and deny the only Lord and our Lord Jesus Christ, or the only God, Lord God, and our Lord Jesus Christ. And so, there's Christians who are abusing this freedom and they can't handle it. And for the second part of the question, what should they do? I think Romans 12, verse 1 sums that up pretty nicely. I beseech you, therefore, brethren, by the mercies of God, that you present your bodies a living sacrifice, holy, acceptable to God, which is your reasonable service. So, becoming bondservants, being living sacrifices to God, is our reasonable service. It's after he paid the blood price, it's reasonable for us to dedicate our lives to him.
Great, thanks. Who else would like to talk about how a person can use freedoms and liberties as a cloak for vice, or are we supposed to do them instead? Well, we're quickly running out of time. I didn't realize we were getting that late. So, thank Landon for his answer. And in the context of this, it very well could, you know, it seems to be directed towards obeying the ruling authority. So, you know, we might use something to say we don't need to pay taxes because the government uses that money for some thing that is not good. But, you know, in Romans 13, 5 through 7, we're directed to pay taxes. In Mark 12, 17, Jesus says, render Caesar's things unto Caesar. Better move on to the next question. How do we honor all people, even those with whom we disagree? Why are these Christians reminded to love the brotherhood? How do we fear God? Why is it important to show honor even the king, the ruling authority? Cole, would you like this question?
Sure. I think we can learn how by looking at the example of Christ. The chapter drops in mind at the moment, but there's a chapter where Jesus is talking about what's wrong with the Pharisees. But before he starts kind of railing into what they're doing wrong, he says that they are due respect as kind of authoritative figures. So we have to have basic respect and civility towards all people, but that doesn't mean that we can't be upfront with them sometimes. But we still have to add that attitude, they are our fellow humans and fellow sinners like us. And why are these Christians reminded to love the brotherhood? This might not be right, but our Christian family is very close to us, and just the church community really helps you out in your life. We're supposed to exhort each other daily, so it's important to really nourish that relationship. That's all I have to say. I don't know if anyone would have anything more to say about that. And then, how do we fear God? So, I've heard people say it's not as much fear as it is respect. It's not fear in the sense that you're going to be paranoid or scared of them, but it's respect in the sense that he has power and he's dangerous, but he's merciful and gracious and kind. And why is it important to show honor to even the king? Again, someone might think differently on this. Maybe there's someone would like to say, but I think it's practicing obedience to things you don't want to be obedient to. Because there are sometimes laws of God that don't align with our human morals, and it's really difficult to follow. And that happens, of course, with our human rulers, too, because they are flawed, so there's going to be more cases where our morals don't align. So if we can be obedient to people who we know are our fellow flawed human beings, then it'll make it easier to follow someone who we someone whose knowledge we can't even comprehend, who can never be wrong, has our best interests at heart.
Okay, all right. Anybody else? Well, for the first part of the question, Landon talked about Jude just a minute ago. In Jude number 9, or verse 9 of Jude, "Yet Michael the archangel, in contending with the devil, when he disputed about the body of Moses, dared not bring against him a reviling accusation, but said, 'The Lord rebuke you.'" So there we have the archangel Michael refusing to curse the devil. Now, that's a pretty hard example to follow there, if you couldn't. And again, I think Cole kind of mentioned it. All people are made in the image of God, so it's back to kind of the murder thing of hating your brother that Jesus talked about. Anybody else on this question? Not bring this lesson to a close.